Well, thank you for inviting me. I'm glad to be here. As a train fan, I love staying in a hotel that was made out of a train depot. Trying to keep within the time frame, it's going to be a little difficult for me. One person got up here and said they were a child of the 70s. I'm a child of the 50s, so I tend to wander down rabbit trails. So I'll try staying off them as much as possible today to try to get through this in 17 slides in 30 minutes. Well, by way of prologue, I'd like to just first of all thank the Minnesota Corn Growers and the Minnesota Corn Research and Promotion Council. A number of years ago, some of us old retired GM people, car people, were talking about the fuel of the future and what it might look like. And we'd heard about the work that was being done on mid-level ethanol blends and thought that there was something that we old secondhand lions could contribute to that discussion. And in particular, the DeFord Group, which I founded, I have a couple of PhD economists. I like to joke I now have more PhD economists than GM does. But I have two, they have one. The two that I have used to work for them. That we could look at it from an economic standpoint, and we teamed up with a couple of other old consultants, Gary Herwick, which many of you may have heard of, who's worked with ethanol interests for a long time, and Tom Darlington, who does air quality studies. And initially, what we intended to do was to just look at the economics, look at the RFS, come up with a nice report, which we did provide at the beginning of 2014. We did most of our study in 2013. But one of the things you find when you're an old consultant, one of the things you live in terror of, is you've spent your life learning things. And what you are afraid of is something that you absolutely know to be true that has somehow changed on you. And as we got into this study, more and more, we found that things had changed very, very rapidly in the ethanol industry. Now, it might, as one ethanol manufacturer told me, they said, well, we've been living with this. It's no surprise to us. Well, yes, but it was a surprise to an outsider like me, and I think it probably will come as a surprise to a lot of people out there in the world how much the ethanol industry has changed and perhaps why it has changed. So, to get to my main point, which is the next chapter in ethanol gasoline blends, I have to start with chapter one, which is the oil. Oil drove the 20th century. Now, I'm not here to bash oil because, quite frankly, oil makes a pretty good transportation fuel. That's why we use so much of it. And perhaps I'm a little bit taken by the fact that oil was first struck in the United States by Edwin Drake. Now, Edwin Drake is no relation of mine, otherwise I wouldn't be working for a living. But he struck the first oil in Pennsylvania. And it was, interestingly, first used as a medicine and lamp oil, as was ethanol. And the gasoline itself was dumped into rivers, the Cuyahoga River, for one, in my hometown of Cleveland. And it was considered a waste product. And that changed very rapidly with the invention of the internal combustion engine, specifically the spark ignition engine. Now, the nice thing about a spark ignition engine, besides the fact that it produces more power per pound than just about anything else and launch such things as aircraft and all sorts of interesting new technologies, is that it could run on gasoline, really likes gasoline. It could also run on ethanol or a blend. In fact, Henry Ford designed the Model T to be an FFV, could run on anything. The importance, I think, of the spark ignition engine is it really freed the automobile to become something more than a child's toy. In 1900, surprisingly, gasoline-powered vehicles came in third after electric vehicles, which were the big main sellers, and steam-powered vehicles. And then finally, there were a few gasoline-powered vehicles or horseless carriages. By 1910, the gasoline vehicle dominated the marketplace in 10 years. And one of the reasons is that it had the long range, and the people that needed the long range and the easy refueling and everything else that gasoline gave them were farmers. Little known fact, farmers put America and the world on wheels. It was a high-value use for the automobile. So this actually, as I say, the spark ignition engine combined with gasoline basically enabled motorization, which first occurred in the United States, then Europe, and now you can see it going on in China and India and the rest of the world. There's a hierarchy economists use in what people want to buy first. The first thing they want to buy, here's my first rabbit trail. First thing they want to buy is televisions. You get up to about $1,000 a year income, you buy a TV. Around the world, you can see huts with TV antennas on them. The next thing you want is a washer and dryer. Surprised me. But then as you get richer and richer, you want a car. And that's true in almost every culture around the world. So, my next slide, since we're in the oil. Oops, how did I? Oh, you got to see it all. Okay. All right, there we go. Oil production, I call it then and now. Now, every year I go to the Energy Information Agency conference. Now, last year when I went, they were virtually euphoric about the idea that we were entering this age of oil abundance with the fracking and the tight oil and everything else. But this year, I think the tone was a little bit more subdued, and perhaps the author David Yergin put it the best. He said, if it weren't for U.S. tight oil, we would be talking about a worldwide oil crisis today. Because the difference between the two, a year ago, we lived in a very stable world. Today, we don't. It's important, though, when we talk about oil. Now, I'm not going to get into the whole peak oil, no peak oil argument and how long it's going to last or anything else. I just want to throw out a couple of statistics. We are pumping more oil out of the ground today than we have ever pumped out of the ground in human history in a day. Now, that may not be true by a few barrels here and there, but you can see by this trend, it's been one of constant growth. Now, BP estimates that we need to add about 20% more in the next couple of decades. We have to pump 20% more oil by 2035 just to meet the worldwide demand in two decades. Now, how much is 20% oil? Is the United States, for example, getting enough tight oil to exceed Saudi Arabia going to do it? Well, look at this next chart. 14 million barrels per day have got to be pumped out of the ground more in 2035 than we're doing today. That's more than the largest oil-producing country today, Russia. It's more than Saudi Arabia, the second largest, and it's more than the United States, the third largest. You could see if our tight oil production raises to the point that we beat Saudi Arabia, that's a drop in the bucket to what we're actually going to have to pump out of the ground to meet worldwide demand. Remember I said the rest of the world has got the money, they want the automobile. Now, another thing from the EIA conference I thought was interesting, and I like throwing in a lot of quotes. So many more people have much more credibility than I do. The head of the International Energy Agency said at the EIA conference, 60% of the growth of oil was expected to come from increasing production in Iraq. Of that 14 billion gallons, 60% of that was getting Iraq up online and fully exploiting its potential. Russia, as I said, is the biggest oil producer. We're imposing sanctions on Russia, as the New York Times reported, to restrict its ability to tap its oil resources. Yeah, we're punishing Russia, all right, but it's going to hurt us, too. As you know, what's happening in the Mideast, ISIS has taken over Syria and Iraq oil fields. BP has pointed out in a recent report that Libya suffered the world's worst decline and that in spite of all this increased U.S. oil production, the price of oil has remained above $100 a barrel for three straight years. Now, that answers the question many people have had, well, if we're getting so much oil out of fracking, why aren't the prices going down? Well, the rest of the world isn't cooperating. And it brings us back to the 20th century in a statement by Winston Churchill. Security and energy lies in diversity, and diversity alone. Now, we are not diverse when it comes to transportation fuel. Okay, why does this do this on me? All right. Technology, you got to love it. So we go to the second chapter, which is ethanol. One of the reasons we're not totally dependent on oil as a transportation fuel is the dramatic rise in ethanol in the last 20 years. Most people don't know it, and in fact, I think they'd be shocked if they were told that 10% of the gasoline contains is not gasoline but ethanol. It really isn't motor fuel. It isn't gasoline anymore. It's motor fuel. And unlike the 20th century revolution with oil, yes, the government did have something to do with creating the ethanol industry through tax credits, through tariff protection for a while, through the RFS. They created a situation of obligated parties and set into motion the need to use biofuels. And what happened after that, though, is what's fascinating, and a lot of what we've been studying. Well, as all of you know, to minimize the cost, which oil companies like to do, they realized, well, there's a lot of octane in ethanol. We can convert our refineries. Instead of putting out 87 octane get regular, we can produce a lower octane fuel. They call it blend stock or Bob. I love Bob. And they started converting the refineries to make Bob. They put the Bob in the pipelines. It goes off to blenders, and then the blenders add 10% ethanol to make it a legal fuel, and it's called regular gasoline. Now, that has in many ways changed your industry, even if you don't appreciate it. Before, you were an alternate fuel, one of those things that if there was a bad crop or something, you didn't have to have. But now you're not so much. You are, like the oil companies, believe it or not, an essential fuel to the transportation system of the United States. The stuff that comes out of the pipelines can't be put into the automobile until you put 10% ethanol in it to bring the octane up to 87 octane. Now, you can see the growth in ethanol use that is kind of stalled there at around the 13 billion mark. So where does ethanol go from here? Well, a lot of what's happened to ethanol was another act of government. Government giveth, and government taketh away. And specifically, at the end of 2011, the government took away the tax credits associated for blenders, which benefited conventional or corn ethanol. And they also eliminated the tariff that was imposed on imported or sugarcane ethanol. Now, you saw that chart earlier today. This is kind of another version of it. During the period before the tax credit was removed and the tariff protection was removed, gasoline and ethanol roughly ran around the same price. They were kind of interchangeable. In fact, there are some studies prior to 2012 that actually, just for simplification, say, we're going to assume a gallon of gasoline and a gallon of ethanol cost the same. And then they do their economic modeling. Well, after that change, the price of ethanol and the price of gasoline decoupled, with the ethanol going down. It's fairly logical when you think about it. What happened was ethanol producers, after they lost the tax credit, couldn't raise the price of ethanol, or else they would be outsold by cane ethanol coming in. And cane ethanol happens to be a twofer. You can use it, generates a better quality RIN than a conventional ethanol. So they had to keep their price down. Well, the university in Illinois did a study that showed that happened by ethanol producers cutting their margins to zero. And, of course, many of you in this room probably appreciate that and had experienced that. But that set off an interesting chain of events where the invisible hand of the market, as ethanol producers tried to make a profit, led them to invest in new technologies that not only reduced the cost, reduced the energy use of ethanol, because the largest cost item outside of the product is the energy. So if you were going to return to profit margins, you had to cut energy use. Another thing that it did was drive even further the drive to genetically modified strains of corn that yielded more ethanol per ear. And now this is coming from a person, by the way, that can't grow a house plant. So if I'm saying anything wrong here, correct me later. I confess my ignorance up front. But my understanding is that you get a lot more ethanol out of an ear of corn. And all of these things have led you back into profitability. It's also reduced your carbon dioxide footprint by quite a bit and lowered your cost. So this is one of the instances where the invisible hand of the market seems to have a green thumb. So right now, where we are today is that E10 is now the new regular fuel. You go out anywhere and you buy regular gas, you get E10. Our study in 2013 showed that even after adjusting for the difference in energy between pure regular gasoline and E10, E10 was still 6 cents a gallon cheaper to the consumer. And over the year in 2013, consumers saved about $8 billion simply because ethanol is the low-cost way for oil companies to add octane. That's why, for example, the Congressional Budget Office indicated that if the RFS went away tomorrow, the oil companies would still blend 10% ethanol into gasoline. They need it for the octane. So all of these people that go around saying, well, the government shouldn't be picking winners and losers, the market should. Well, right now the market, at least up to the 10% level, has already picked a winner. It's ethanol. And perhaps I'm overly optimistic. There is some advantage of not really knowing a whole lot about something. You can get really excited as you get into it. And coming in kind of lately, I've been getting really excited about ethanol. I do have to confess, back when I worked at GM and this first came along, I thought corn ethanol was the dumbest thing I had ever heard of. Kind of like Mark Twain, I am amazed at how much I've learned since then. Ethanol's future, I think, looks even better. Probably one of the best predictors or forecasters of ethanol prices in terms of actually getting it right have been the economists at the University of Missouri, FAPRI. And last year when they did their forecast, and they forecast kind of a midterm forecast, they forecast that ethanol prices, as expressed as, in this case, as a percent of gasoline, which is the easiest way to look at it, would start falling over the years and would be approaching energy price parity. In other words, where a dollar worth of ethanol buys you the same number of British thermal units of energy as a dollar's worth of gasoline, so they have the same energy content. Approaching energy price parity may be around 2025, if you follow that line out. Their latest report says we're probably going to reach that point this year. We may have already reached it, except for the fact that, as you know, last winter, many of the tank cars in the United States miraculously disappeared. And so, as I've been following the price, there's a big price blip. Now it's settled down again. Ethanol selling about $2.25, I think, a gallon in the last OPIS report. So it remains to be seen whether FAPRI's prediction comes true, that ethanol fuel reaches energy price parity this year, but it seems to be on track to do that. Now, it's interesting that energy price E85, which is the only time I'll touch on E85, is actually below energy price parity at some points in the country already. Now, in our 2013 study, we said that E85 would have to sell 72 cents a gallon less than E10 in order to have the equivalent amount of energy per dollar that the consumer spends. Now, there's been a new model in the Midwest. I won't get into the details, but I call it direct-to-retailer, where ethanol plants sell E85 directly to retailers rather than running it through blenders. And there are places that are selling it for a dollar a gallon less than E10. Now, this picture, in case you don't believe me, This picture is an actual picture of the gas station that I fill up with when I get my E85 and Tim Hortons coffee. And it's not far away from me, and they've been consistently selling E85 at $1 a gallon a year. And I can tell you from experience that it attracts quite a lot of customers to their one E85 pump. Myself among them, because I do like a good bargain. So it's probably getting back to that old adage that you have to watch out for things that change on you. Okay. It's important to remember yesterday's arguments are not tomorrow's reality. So much has changed in the ethanol industry due to new technology, due to the market drivers of losing the tax credits and the tariff protection, that studies that are done before 2012 are not always reliable. For that includes, for example, the big API study done by NERA, a perfectly reputable, one of the best consulting firms in economics, but they relied on a study that was done in 2011 for their economic data. And they had no way of knowing that the whole foundation of that study, the idea that ethanol and gasoline cost the same, was shifting out from under them. Similarly, the recent CBO report relies very heavily on, or overweights, I would say, studies done before 2012. So just as a rule of thumb, when you're looking at ethanol and doing studies, particularly in economics or the carbon footprint, you got to remember that these studies are a little like milk. They have an expiration date on them. So simple way to remember, do not use if written before 2012, because it's probably going to have the wrong answer in it. And it's not because anybody's trying to game the system. It's just before 2012, they were operating on a presumption and backed up by facts that ethanol costs the same as gasoline. That just isn't true anymore. And others are recognizing what's been going on. One of my favorites is University of California in Davis, Institute for Transportation Studies, just did a report, and as you can see, they talk about considerable innovation in the production of corn ethanol, and they talk about these new processes that 80% of the plants have, switching to low-carbon fuel sources, lowering energy use, and then bringing up the higher yield from genetically modified corn. Well, that gets me out of ethanol for a moment. There we go. Want to get into my favorite area, which is cars. Now, the car in the middle has some significance to me personally because I learned to drive on the poor cousin of that car. And that was an interesting car. It had a 352 cubic inch Hemi engine, high compression, was not subject to virtually any regulation, certainly no emission or fuel economy regulation, and got a wonderful 8 mile per gallon downhill on leaded gasoline. But since leaded gasoline costs less than a quarter of a gallon, it really didn't matter. Now, since then, there's been a lot of standards imposed on the automobile. First of all, there have been standards on the fuel, largely driven by what's now called the Energy Independence and Security Act. And it's kind of two parts in both the case of tailpipe emissions and fuels. You have standards that are enacted, like the corporate average fuel economy standard, and then you have mandates like the RFS, the biofuels mandate. Similarly, in the automobile end of the business, tailpipe end, you have greenhouse gas and other emission standards that are set by the Clean Air Act, and then you have mandates for electric vehicles that happen to be regulated by California. But altogether, they present a package of mandates and standards. And also, it's important to note that since the advent of the catalytic converter, regulations now treat fuels and vehicles as a system. So EPA not only regulates vehicles, but they make changes to the fuel specifications in order to make the vehicles, help the vehicles meet the standards. And that's important in this discussion of mid-level blends. See if I can flip this one at a time. There we go. A lot of competition out there, or not competition, but really alternatives for providing additional diversity oil. You hear a lot about natural gas, usually in advertisements by Boone Pickens, and natural gas has its place. It's obviously abundant, but in transportation, it really isn't a good use except in very big vehicles where it can have massive tanks. They're more expensive to produce. There's a complex refueling involved. You're doing high-pressure gas. And some areas of the country, like the Northeast, don't even have gas lines, natural gas lines installed. So getting the fuel everywhere is difficult, and you don't have a lot of retail outlets. Now, places like bus fleets and everything are tremendously successful with natural gas because they have a centralized refueling point. And you have to remember that natural gas, while having lower CO2 emissions, is still a fossil fuel. Then you have electricity, the darling of the year 1900. It still has limited range. The batteries are very costly to replace. You're talking about a $10,000 battery replacement at some point. That's one heck of a maintenance item. And the cars, because of the battery, are still expensive. You have the whole problem of putting in in-house charging. You've got a long refueling time. I know they're working on that. And you still have very few retail chargers out there in the public. And ultimately, at the other end of the pump is a power plant, end of the plug is a power plant, and that power plant, more often than not, burns fossil fuels. So while electricity also has its place in the future transportation system, it probably is going to be the same place it had in 1900 in the cities, where the disadvantages of electric vehicles are far outweighed by its advantages. But for the vast bulk of us, those people that live and drive in the country, that are on farms, small towns around rural America, places where there aren't rechargers and gas lines and everything else, liquid fuels are still going to predominate well through the 21st century. And that's where biofuels, and really only biofuels, can make a big difference in terms of diversity and renewability. The beauty of biofuels is they provide the same utility and performance as today's cars. They're really pretty transparent to the consumer. They don't cost a lot more. FFVs are usually sold at no additional cost to the consumer. You have familiar refueling. I can tell you the friends that I have gotten standing around the E85 pump in Fenton, these people are not what you would call early adapters. With their old pickup trucks that have the rusted out FFV logo on them. Rather, they're people like you and me. They recognize a good bargain, and they refueling with the E85 is just as similar to them as refueling with gasoline. It uses existing infrastructure. You've got all the gas stations out there. And the nice thing is, and I realize this is a little bit heresy to say this, but while most all ethanol today that's sold is made from renewable sources, in a pinch you can also make it from non-renewable sources. So like electricity, it can come from a wide variety of feedstocks. Now, it's important that while we have adapted to oil as a transportation fuel, neither oil nor ethanol by themselves are a perfect transportation fuel. And largely because of something called octane. Now, I've mentioned it before. In case you don't know, octane is a measure of a gasoline's resistance to pre-igniting. The idea in an internal combustion engine is you want the engine to fire when the spark plug tells it to. But as you compress the fuel in the air in a cylinder, the cylinder gets hot. If I remember my engineering, that's PV equals NRT. But anyway, it gets hot, and gasoline has a tendency to ignite on its own before the spark plug fires as the compression takes place, and that's called pre-ignition or knock, and that can destroy an engine. So the thing you do is you try to increase the octane rating. The octane rating is simply a measure of how resistant the gasoline is to compression. So if you have low octane in your rating of your gasoline, that limits the amount of compression you can have in your engine. The lower the compression, the lower the thermal efficiency. So it's an upper bound to how efficient you can make the engine, which is why the conundrum of why you can raise octane and improve fuel economy, because you simply increase the thermal efficiency of the engine. But that requires a vehicle change. Now, gasoline, its big advantage, it's the king when it comes to energy density. There's more BTU per gallon in that thing, in that fuel, than practically any other transportation fuel. Unfortunately, it also has a fairly low octane reading. Ethanol, while having less energy, has a very high octane reading. So as it turns out, the low-cost use of ethanol is to boost octane. As we said, in E10, it saves consumers about 6 cents a year. And in E10, because the oil companies have dropped the blend stock octane, ethanol's octane is fully utilized. Octane is really a terrible thing to waste. Now, on the other hand, when you use E85, you create a fuel with more octane than the engine can possibly use. As one engineer put it from Mercedes, if you tried to design an engine to use all the octane in E85, the engine would probably blow up. So as a result, you actually pay a little bit more on an energy-adjusted basis for E85, at least now, although as I pointed out in that previous slide, I don't pay more per BTU for E85 because I get it for $1 a gallon less than regular. But not everybody's so lucky to live near a station like that. So on the average, you pay about 30. Last year, we figured about 32 cents a gallon more for E85 on an energy-adjusted basis. And that's largely because the octane advantage of ethanol is simply wasted. But you have to put that in perspective of the energy security benefit, which I won't go into because I realize I'm running over. But that's about 46 cents a gallon. And even E85 on a social basis is still probably cost beneficial. Now, automakers want higher octane. For them, that's a way to get more efficient high compression engines. Allows you to commonize powertrains because in Europe you already have a standard fuel that's high octane. And lower CO2 tailpipe emissions because you make the engine more efficient. Even if it doesn't get more miles per gallon with a higher octane fuel, it'll still get lower CO2 emissions. But the reason that automakers don't do it now with regular or premium gasoline as much as they could is that premium sells for about 36 cents a gallon more than regular. About 30 cents more than regular. So nobody's going to buy it, as was indicated. Even the cars that require it aren't getting it. In Automotive News ran an article this year, Ford said it's a common sense thing. Put in higher compression ratio, and you won't be knock limited with high-octane fuel. Chrysler, who's now owned by a European firm, interestingly enough, was very concerned that with a high-octane fuel, it would allow you to have common powertrains with Europe. And GM, I'm not sure where they were coming from unless they were channeling their inner Montgomery Scott, but they were saying you just can't deny the laws of physics. Now, one thing I have learned is that Mercedes is now testing vehicles in Germany that run on high-octane E20, E25. And they're testing in Germany some of the performance specifications. And, of course, what they're finding is somewhat classified, but we kind of have a guess what's going on. So that finally brings me what I call an affordable high-octane fuel or eco-performance fuel. Now, the national labs call it super renewable premium. One thing I don't want to call it is a mid-level blend, because when you think of mid-level blends, you think of E85 with a little SE in it, something that you're just using to get rid of the ethanol. What we're talking about here is a fuel that would be widely available that would allow auto manufacturers to build advanced vehicles. So it's actually a new fuel, needs a new name. I throw in eco-performance fuel as my candidate for that name. But call it what you will as long as you don't call it a mid-level blend. What is needed by the automakers is a 98 research octane number. Won't get into the details of how that differs, which is kind of similar to our 93 octane at the pump. We want something clearly that's made from proven components. We've had enough experiments with ways of boosting octane in gasoline with additives like MMT, lead, MTBE, and other things, all of which have had disastrous environmental consequences. Ethanol, on the other hand, is a proven component. It allows you then to have your base fuel be an E10, which can power all the legacy vehicles, and then you can add ethanol to bring it up to 98 RON octane, either at the blender or at the retail level. It doesn't matter, so that it gives you a little added flexibility. The automakers get their higher compression ratios and efficient engines, and what they're discovering, if you boost the octane with ethanol, there's another factor. It cools the charge going into the engine, and it gives you a little extra boost. It actually, the ethanol-gasoline blend enhances combustion. So if you do all that, what do you get? Well, you get a car that has equal or probably better fuel economy than today's vehicle operating on E10 that would be similar. And what they're finding is this combination tremendously boosts the torque of the engine, or the turning power, which is less famous than horsepower, but when it goes to accelerating the vehicle off a line, very important, it produces twice as much torque than today's vehicles running on E10. So that might even allow for further engine downsizing, which then improves fuel economy. So why would you want to do this? This is a major undertaking, and it's not going to be done by any one group. Last time something this big was done was back in the 1970s. I'm old enough to remember the switch to unleaded gasoline from leaded gasoline. And that required a lot of people to work together to make it happen. So why bother? Well, the first reason, it's cleaner. As I mentioned, lower CO2 emissions, but also lower toxic emissions. In order to boost the octane of petroleum gasoline, blenders have to put in a lot of aromatics. The aromatics are cancer-causing compounds, and right now, premium gas, I understand, has about half aromatics in it. Clearly, as this lower-quality fuel comes out of the Balkans and other fracking sites, they're going to have to put more of that in to get octane, unless, of course, they turn to something like ethanol. And it's also cheaper, as I mentioned before. Now, our study, using some FAPRI numbers, shows that it starts out about 20 cents a gallon cheaper, but over time grows to as much as 40 cents a gallon cheaper to make than E10. And the simple reason for that is, over time, as I pointed out, as FAPRI predicted, the spread between gasoline and ethanol prices they expected increase. So, and then the other good reason, besides it being cleaner and cheaper, is I think it's better. For the automakers, I've already explained why that would help them. Also, by going to more robust technology, such as higher compression ratios instead of perhaps, you know, exotic turbocharging, they can make the vehicle more robust. Also, they can cut the cost of it to the consumer. For the consumers, they directly save fuel if, again, the eco-performance fuel gets priced at based on its cost, and that would be a cheaper fuel than E10. They could save up to $900 over the lifetime of the car. It's insurance against oil price shocks, and it could add up to 170,000 jobs in the United States by 2035 if you add the additional jobs created in the auto industry and in the ethanol industry. Although they are not ready to admit it yet, it could be better for the oil companies. Well, for one thing, they don't have to worry about the blend wall. The blend wall, over time, slowly over time, would go up to 30% or whatever that number happens to be, 25-30%. And it would still be able to market as usual. They wouldn't require any changes to the refineries or distribution system. They'd still make E10, send it to the blenders. The blenders would add ethanol. They could add enough ethanol to make E10. They could make another product that is the EPF, or they could ship the E10 to the retailers and have the retailers add the additional ethanol, which opens up new opportunities for the ethanol industry. You could have more and more of this direct-to-retail sales of ethanol, fuel ethanol, than you have going on now, rather than shipping it to a blender. And ultimately, it could potentially triple the amount of essential ethanol in the fuel system, ethanol that's not subsidized, it saves the consumer money, and it's an essential part of the fuel supply. In other words, I'll say it in this room, over time you would basically become an equal partner in the transportation fuel system, or let's say a third partner, with the oil companies. You'd have 30%, they'd have 70%. It'd change the dynamics. You might actually have to get used to living with those people, and vice versa. And then for retailers, they have a low-cost fuel to offer the consumers and a product to replace right now premium, which if I'm a retailer, I would look at the premium pump and say, why am I doing this? And as we heard earlier, it's because they have to. Now they wouldn't have to. They'd have a premium product that have ever-increasing sales in the form of eco-performance fuel. So real quickly, so I can give Paul some time to get up here. I think ethanol's proven itself. It's gone from nothing to 13 billion gallons a year. That's impressive in two decades. At least if you're as old as I am, that's impressive. And to my amazement, it's replaced 10% of the gasoline in the country. Saved consumers $8 billion a year. Now, it also has the potential to help address some 21st century problems. And keep in mind, we're talking eco-performance fuel. We're not talking tomorrow or the next day or the next day. We're talking about a fuel that may not come into widespread use until the early 2020s. Won't hit full peak until 2035, 2040. So we're really talking about a fuel for the middle of the 21st century. But I think it can help reduce a lot, solve a lot of society's problems. And this question about changing the gasoline, it changes all the time. It changed in 1970s with unleaded gas, in 1990 when leaded gas was completely banned, except for small airplanes, but that's another story. Rabbit trail, I won't go down. Reformulated gas came along. It has to be marketed in certain cities at certain times. Now regular gas is 10% ethanol. Gasoline changes all the time, so why not eco-performance fuel? I think it can be the next chapter. And just to close with one thought, and I figure I'll give the oil companies the last word on this one. The head of research at Saudi Aramco wrote a book, came out beginning of the year, and he speculated on his vision of what the fuels of the future would be like for transportation. And he said, as the spark ignition engines are developed, become more efficient, NOx will become more likely, fuels of high anti-NOx quality and with a high RON will enable future engines to reach their full potential. And then he added, ethanol would be very important in making such fuels. I think rather than worrying about the facts and the arguments and everything, I'm excited about seizing this vision. I even like using the words of the head researcher at Saudi Aramco. Let's look for a new fuel for the middle of the 21st century, and if you do it objectively and honestly, I think you're going to find it's going to contain a lot of ethanol. Thank you.